Welcome back to Messy in the Middle. With me today, I have Alexandria Theodore. Alex is a therapist and business coach for therapists, helping them stress less as therapists. Alex, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. When I learned about your show and started following you on Instagram, which I mean, your dog is adorable, by the way. I have such a soft spot for pitties, that I knew I needed to get in touch with you. So the fact that I'm here, I'm just thrilled.
Yes, I'm so glad you're here. And also, I think we went to the same undergrad, right?
We did, TC yes. And J. I was T4, although I think that the towers are gone now from rumor that I hear that they're taking those down.
I think so too. And if we're being honest, I'm going to get crucified for this by like our one other TCNJ listener. I'm kind of glad about it because I transferred. And so everyone has these like freshman year like towers stories, and I don't. So I'm glad that I'm not alone anymore.
Everyone's on an equal playing field.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's very different. I have my college roommate and I annually go to visit. We have lunch there on campus, and it looks nothing like when I went. So it's very, very weird to be back. And then it makes me feel really old, but we still keep going just because it grounds us, because it's where our roots are. But yeah, it was a great place. I really enjoyed it there.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a nice campus. Like, I don't go back very often, but it is very nice to be there. And I kind of miss just like, I don't know. I think I just miss being in college. And like not having responsibilities. So that's actually a perfect place for us to get started. What did you want to be when you grow up? Like, what did you go to college for? Was a therapist always the plan, or was it a windy, twisty road?
I think therapist was always the plan. I always wanted to do like the one-on-one sessions, but my original thought was to do it like pre-med psychiatry. And then as I went through TCNJ and kind of went through actual kind of clinical stuff through courses and field placements, I felt that psychiatry was much more medicine focused and like, here's a prescription, see you later, where I had this romantic vision of like actually knowing my patients. And that's eventually how I ended up in social work, because I can do the therapy that I always dreamed of doing. But then I also had this umbrella of opportunity with the MSW degree to switch it up if I wanted to. I did adoption work for some time when I was a student and eventually made my way back to the clinical and ended up doing my clinical specialty with like chronic illness and survivors of brain injury and things like that. But even to this day, it's still evolved, I think, because life evolves. I evolve, and it's nice to have a degree that is flexible with that too.
Yeah, definitely. I remember when I applied as a transfer student to TCNJ, I like thought I was going to be a doctor. So I really wanted to be an allergist because I have a lot of food allergies and I never liked my allergists. So I was like, I'm going to be different. And then I applied as like a bio major or whatever. And TCNJ was like, no, you're not going to do that. Like literally.
Really?
They basically sent me an email that was like, you're waitlisted. Pick any other major and you can come here. And I was like, okay, I guess that's like a sign that
I wonder what about the bio they were so like snobby about.
Well, like I wasn't good at science, so I like had no business applying as a biology major or like any of that. So, you know, it was definitely for the better, but in the moment I was like, wow, okay, rude. Now I have to figure out what I want to do with my life. Because I think the idea of like going to medical school is like, it's so long, you get to kind of like postpone thinking for a while about like anything other than studying.
I still to this day, I mean, looking back, I think it's crazy that as a 18-19 year old, you have to decide what you're going to do for the rest of your life at that point and do it forever. I always knew that I wanted to do therapy in some capacity, but I never expected to do private practice. I never expected to do business coaching.
Right.
So the fact that I ended up here baffles me, but I also wouldn't have it any other way.
Right. Well, that's actually takes me to the only other question that I really had prepared, which is like, when you decided to become a therapist, go into counseling, like what does the typical career path look like for that? Because every therapist I know is in private practice. But also every therapist I know is like, I never imagined going into private practice. So like, What do you do if you're not in private practice as a therapist?
You're usually working at some type of agency, and that's how I started, and that's how a lot of my friends who are in private practice started. And it's great. It's fantastic experience. I don't regret any of the agencies that I worked for, but the one common thread is people tend to burn out real fast because unfortunately there's always low funding. There seems to be this really weird conundrum in the therapy world that the newest, freshest person to the field tends to get the highest, most acute need of patient, which I don't know who made up that system, but that really does need to be reversed at some point in time. So you start out your first year with these like bright eyes, hopes, and dreams of I'm going to change the world, and then you get thrown these cases that are sometimes destitute, and you're just trying to help people literally survive, get through day to day. And reality hits you, you're like, what did I just sign up for? And I mean, it's a great learning experience, and you figure it out, and you grow so much from it. But there's also only a point where then, at least for me, my life became my work, right? And that wasn't sustainable. And at some point, mostly out of kind of necessity after the pandemic, I was like, I can't do this anymore. And that's how I wound up ending up in private practice. So I can do what I loved and work with those people that I loved, but in a way that was sustainable for me personally, physically, but also financially.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. And it seems to be like why a lot of therapists wind up going into private practice. But something else that I feel like they don't teach you in college is then how to run a private practice and also be a business owner on top of being a therapist and like doing so much kind of emotional labor in your day-to-day work. I'm guessing they really don't tell you how to teach people how to start their own private practices. So, how did you then go from working for an agency to starting your own private practice to then essentially being like the private practice therapist, like for people to become their own, business owners? Like, what was that kind of pipeline like for you?
So I was working at a hospital-based agency for years, and I loved it. I had a fantastic team of staff that I worked with, but none of them were therapists. They were all different specialties: speech therapists, occupational therapists, and we helped the brain injured community. And I did that while I was getting my license hours to be a full-fledged LCSW. It also was a stepping stone because I knew that at the rate that I was getting paid, it wasn't sustainable for my life. And at that time, I had recently got engaged, I was getting married, and I knew what we wanted to build together, and that included a family. And I genuinely was fearful for how I was going to support that family. I mean, yes, my husband works and he makes good money, but I always grew up in a world where I can take care of myself as well, that we work together, and I'm not just going to sit there with pearls in a dress and be taken care of kind of thing. So I
But
wanted
like,
to have
wouldn't
that
it be
stability.
nice?
It would be nice, but as someone who currently is in like a stay-at-home mom position, and I made that choice to prioritize my life, and I wouldn't have it any other way. I also crave the work piece, and that's how I think I ended up doing some of that business coaching, because I was still doing therapy, and I still to this day do therapy, but my caseload is drastically reduced, in part because of my schedule, because I am prioritizing parenting my daughter as she's running around the house in this potty training stage. But also, I also knew emotionally I could only handle so much emotional space for people, and managing a toddler requires a lot of emotional space, and I wanted to be 100% for the clients that I was seeing. So I needed to diversify that somehow, and that was how I ended up into the coaching piece of it. So I do a little bit of both, which I honestly wouldn't have it any way because I get both ends of the spectrum.
Right. When it comes to like structuring the coaching side of your business, what was that like for you in like deciding what kinds of offers you wanted to have or how you wanted to work with people? Because I feel like In marketing, it's like, okay, we offer marketing services. In web design or graphic design, it's like, okay, we offer design services. But like this very specific niche of, I feel like you could go in so many different directions with it. And like whatever you choose, like you just kind of got to go all in and hope that it works. So how did you kind of decide what route you wanted to take with the coaching arm of your business?
It's a lot of experimenting. I mean, I started out with digital courses and stuff that I would do a live webinar. I would have it recorded, so whoever wanted to attend kind of that live group coaching was able to. But then if they wanted to just watch the replay, they can do that and purchase that on their own time. And then I also do the one-on-one piece of it, and that's I love it because it allows me to be that kind of big sister that I didn't get to have when I was building my own therapy practice. Someone to just kind of, is this okay? Like, is this normal? Because you're right, they don't teach any of this in grad school. And God forbid you ask, a lot of times they kind of mock and say, you'll figure it out, or like, pay your dues first and then you'll get there. But just some of the basics of like, how do you market yourself, and how do you market yourself in a way that's not sleazy, which is why I always loved your mission of doing it ethically. And I think, especially as a therapist, like that word in particular really stands out as like how to be ethical, but also transparent, and make a profit, because it is business at the end of the day, right? Sometimes it's hard to say that because we want to help people, and a lot of us would do it even if it was free, but we still have bills to pay. There are practical things that need to get done.
That's actually interesting that you bring up kind of the ethical side of things, because this has been a conversation that has been happening a lot with us behind the scenes lately about like, well, what is ethical marketing actually? Because if you look up like the definition of ethics, it's like to do something in accordance to your values. And it's like, okay, well, your values can be shitty and you can still technically be like running an ethical business. So to then bring in that element of, we have to make money, we would do it for free, and like figuring out the pricing and all of that stuff, it really, I think, speaks to the complex problem that is, using ethics in your marketing or whatever. And then also sometimes there's like the superiority complex that I find people have when it comes to ethical marketing. So they'll ask me, like, oh, what is trauma-informed marketing? Which I chose because it has a more like concrete definition than ethical marketing. And then I explain it and they're like, oh, well, I mean, I probably do that anyway. Like, I'm not gonna like think about the hard stuff and think about like the potentially like negative ramifications of the work that we're doing.
I mean, and then there's also the added piece of sometimes there's like concrete black and white rules that have to be filed. Like, I know here in New Jersey, in the social work kind of regs, I cannot use my LCSW letters unless I'm providing the clinical service. So if you look at my coaching business and products and website, you will not see LCSW anywhere. You will not see myself market as a therapist, right? You will see me market myself as a private practice owner, right? And you can connect the dots. You can see me marketing myself, like I have in my little name thing here as an MSW, right? And again, connect the dots. But putting the LC in front of things, it can be that ethical piece because it could play with people saying, like, oh, like hire me because I'm a therapist, but I'm not doing therapy. And so even those little nuances are really important to know, and things that I had no idea of when I first started. And if I can create a shortcut for somebody else in their practice with throwing out those things that I learned along the way, that's what I love about the coaching piece of it.
Yeah, there's like a lot to navigate there.
Yeah.
But that's something that I've also noticed because we do work with a lot of people who are in the therapy space and then are trying to figure out ways to work with clients in other states or offer different types of services or even just not feel so restricted by their marketing, getting into like doing the coaching piece so that it's not therapy. Or just like marketing themselves in a different way so that they're not as restricted. I guess I would love to know what you think about that as like a trend maybe in your industry of people like getting these credentials and then using something else because it's easier to market. Or just like any thoughts you have on that. That wasn't a very coherent question.
Yeah, no, I but I think I get where you're going though, because there are a lot of people who are maybe getting some of the education, or maybe even the full education, but then slapping the word coach on things, like an EMDR coach, but then doing EMDR. And that's where it feels, even saying it, like it feels skeezy. And I'm hoping, or and I'm sure that these people don't have skeezy intentions. They just want to help people, but they're feeling trapped by the regulations. That's why when I picked coaching for therapists, I picked something that was so far outside of the realm of what I do in my therapy business because I didn't want there to be any confusion. And that's how I can kind of sleep at night from an ethical perspective of knowing if someone looks at my websites that there's no overlap. If someone asks me what I do as a therapist and what I do as a coach, there shouldn't be any question that I do my therapy for people who have chronic medical illnesses or are family members of people with chronic medical illnesses. I do coaching for therapists and business strategies in particular. And that is important because sometimes people think it's clinical supervision. And I have to be like, ooh, thank you. And I'm honored that you want to work with me. But that's not actually what I do. That's more of a clinical piece. So it really is checking in with your own motives and what's the goal of what you're trying to do. And is it coaching or is it actually therapy or clinical?
And I think that's a really smart way, though, to leverage your expertise so that, like, you are doing two different things and it's very black and white, you know, which is therapy and which is coaching, but you're not just like a therapist by day and like a gardening instructor by night. Like, there still is that tie, and you're able to leverage that expertise, which I think is really cool. When it comes to the types of clients that you work with, do you find that you are working with other, you know, aspiring private practice owners who also maybe want to get into like some sort of coaching? Because we get into like the coaches who coach coaches space a lot in like our conversations here. Do you find that you're working with people who just like want to have the freedom of their own private practice, or that they're also thinking like, oh, you're doing this cool thing, like you've got two sides of the same coin, I want to do that too?
I tend to have two different camps. So I have one camp that is like you're saying, like there are other private practice therapists who want to diversify in some way, shape, or form. Maybe they don't want to build a group practice, but they still want to bring in some extra money. Or they want to reduce the amount of hours that they're seeing face-to-face clients, and so they're trying to figure out other creative ways to use their clinical expertise that's not sitting one-on-one in a room. The other camp that I get are those either pre-licensed therapists or brand new therapists, and usually it's LCSWs just because they relate to the social work background, and they've either seen people before them or they have their first year in their agency job and they're like, whoa, like this can't be everything. And now their mind is swimming with what ifs. And sometimes they just need somebody who is there for that mindset, that support, showing them what options so they can make those informed decisions. Whereas oftentimes the first group, the therapists who are in private practice, they know a certain set of business skills, like how to run their clinical business, but they're not sure how to kind of switch it into, say, a coaching or a passive income product, and how do you protect yourself but also still maintain that license?
Gotcha. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk more about the marketing side of both of your businesses, actually. What does it look like to market a private practice? Because I feel like, you know, I've done market research for therapists, and we say like, oh, how do you know, try to find a therapist? They like, I look for therapists near me, and I get the first one that has an opening, and like that seems to be the end of that. So what are some of maybe the challenges, but then also the benefits of marketing for private practice specifically that you've noticed?
I think it depends a lot on who your client is, right? Your ideal client, but then also, quite frankly, if you're insurance-based or if you're not insurance-based, right? Because if you're insurance-based, you have a bit more flexibility in the fact that you don't have to, I don't want to say you don't have to work as hard as your marketing, because there's still a lot of hard work that goes into it, but you have someone else kind of feeding clients into you, or you can kind of put your name on Google My Business and list what insurances you have, so the therapy near me pops up. Same thing with psychology today. That's probably one of the biggest referral sources I get, and most likely because people are putting in whatever town they live in, and then the insurance that they have, and a whole list of people pop up. If you're working either with a very specific population like I do, or maybe don't take all the different insurances, or maybe no insurances, I'm finding that content marketing is really important and helpful. And for me, I'm personally really fond of blogging. For other people, it's podcasts, YouTube, social media. For me personally, hasn't been the biggest. I use social media as a way to support my other, like it's a nurturing tool versus like a content tool. But getting a chance for people to get to know you and what they do, because therapy is a personal decision, right? Especially if you're going in for a very specific reason, you want to make sure that person on the other side of the chair understands what you've been from and can help you. And blogging, for example, is a great way to kind of show and tell without someone having to physically be in that room.
Right. And I can also imagine probably that blogging is a safer way to build credibility than maybe like having a podcast or showing up a lot on social media, because I would imagine as a therapist, like you don't want to be in a position where like your clients are like developing these like parasocial relationships with you where they feel like they know you, but like they're not really supposed to know you. Like navigating that, I feel would probably be incredibly tricky, and I think it's easier to have that separation in the blogging space, right?
There's definitely boundaries that have to be considered, regardless of what platform you use. I like blogging, one, for the flexibility in it, like time-wise. So like I can have a blog in my head of, say, I wanted to talk about the five different ways to manage anxiety without relying to medication, and that's my blog post for the week. I can outline it on Monday in between client sessions. I can write a first draft on Tuesday between sessions. I don't have to worry about having a chunk of time and blocking out that what could be a therapy hour to do the recording, to do the editing, to do it kind of all in one shot. Because especially with the video, once you start, it's really hard to stop. Blogging, I can do it in between sessions, or if I have a cancellation. And then pick up where I left off. And I can also go back and edit it. If something happens that either things change or there's a new discovery, or maybe I was flat out wrong and need to kind of correct myself, I can do that very easily with updating a blog versus a video. I kind of either have to make an addendum and make a new video for it, or take it down, start all over, and then re-upload it again.
Yeah, there's definitely more longevity with blogging as a marketing tool for sure. Over on the business coaching side of things, do you find that, I've experienced, the reason I have this podcast, like building a personal brand is such a big part of establishing credibility as a coach and like building your own, name for yourself. Do you find that the limitations you want to abide by for the therapy side of your business have an impact on the way that you're able to market the coaching side of your business? Because like whether you're marketing yourself as a coach or you're marketing yourself as a therapist, you're still out there for people to see.
I don't know if I do it very differently, simply because my therapy clients could still find my coaching business. And quite frankly, a lot
Right,
of
that's
times
what I'm
I tell
saying.
them about it. Like I have it in my paperwork that, hey, this is something else that I do. So if you see it, don't be alarmed kind of thing. And it's more of a personal choice of how much like personal disclosure happens. There are some therapists that are very old school and don't share a single thing about themselves. And so I imagine from a marketing perspective and building a personal brand that would be really difficult to do. I'm kind of in between. I mean, I'm not one to share my whole life story, and I definitely don't share things just for the sake of sharing it. I usually only share it if there's an actual therapeutic or clinical, and even the business side, if there's a reason for it. But I also think it's a human profession. It would be unfair for the client to kind of just be alone in this. That I want them to know that they're not alone, that I get it, that I have emotions, that I can relate to what they're saying. And so showing some of that personality in a personal brand, I think, can be really valuable for both sides of the spectrum, the coaching and the therapy piece of it.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, now I want to switch gears again to the way we got to know each other, which is bundles. You approached me a few months back about participating in the Stress Less Therapist bundle. Some of my audience will probably remember seeing me share about it, not as much as I had intended to, but share about it. And I was so excited then when you pitched to be on the podcast because I want to know more about being on the other side of a bundle. So I've participated in a bunch of bundles, but I've never hosted one, mostly because it feels like a lot of admin and that's not my strong suit. So I would love to know, what's your experience been like with bundles and what made you decide that you wanted to host your own this year?
I actually got the idea from a business mentor of mine, Kate Oster. She does a lot of email marketing specific stuff. And it's a great way to get your name out there, to collaborate with other professionals that you maybe have never had a chance to work with before or need that kind of icebreaker introduction. And is also a really great way to kind of treat your audience because at least the bundle that I did, there was a free bundle. So they get a lot of stuff for free, which normally they would have had to pay quite a lot of money for if they were buying it kind of a la carte. This was my first bundle. It was a lot of work, but it was also a lot of fun. You're right. It is a lot of admin work, but I also really enjoy the behind the scenes admin. That's part of why I think I do the business coaching and the private practices. I love like the behind the scenes at business analytics, all of that stuff. Especially after you have a really tough clinical day, it's nice to kind of completely turn to the other side of the brain. But Kate made it super easy, and she has a course that I took, and she kind of walked through step by step, and even had some templates that I can use and do. So as overwhelming as it felt at times, because I had that mentor and that coach that really can walk you through it, I really benefited from it. So it's a lot of work this year. Next year will be super easy because then I can just update things and tweak things that I would have preferred, but I knew it was going to be an investment. And it's kind of the same thing when I started private practice and even when I started the coaching business, is I knew it was going to be an investment the first time I did it. But then once I did it, it just gets better and better. So I had a lot of fun hosting it, and I'm hoping to do another one again. I don't know if I'm going to do September though. That was the one thing. I think if I was going to mix it up, I've learned that coming out of the summer, a lot of people like to take the summers off. So replies were really slow. And then also October, beginning of the holiday season, like everybody then does a bundle. And I was like, okay, maybe we do it at a different time. So I haven't exactly picked when it's going to be, but I definitely intend on doing it again. I just haven't decided the exact date just yet.
Gotcha. Well, that was going to be my follow-up question was like, is there going to be another one? But it sounds like there is. When you went through the process of like selecting people to be a part of the bundle, a lot of times it's like people just choosing their friends because like everyone has friends in kind of adjacent industries. But obviously you and I didn't know each other before the bundle. So how did you go about finding people to feature in the bundle and what was that process like for you?
This doesn't make me sound like such a creep, a lot of Facebook stalking, quite frankly. Like I would go through the different Facebook groups that I was a part of because I knew that we all kind of had the same heart mission from a business perspective. And I would look at what people had to offer. And if there was something that really stood out as a skill set that they exceeded far better than I could ever do, or something that maybe I didn't touch on at all and knew my audience would really benefit from, those were the emails that I sent out first. And you were one of those first people, especially from that marketing perspective of like, hey, I know people will just go crazy and really can benefit from what you have to say. So is there a way that we can work together in way, some way, shape, or form? And a lot of people took me up on it right off the bat. Some people, they just couldn't because they had other kind of responsibilities at the time. And so we found other ways to collaborate. So it was a really great icebreaker. But Facebook was by far my biggest kind of intro point. That and the second would be then podcasts. But it was kind of like that cold calling. I would go through podcasts that I was personally listening to and reach out to them and be like, hey, I've been following for a while. Is there any chance that you're interested in doing this? And send the message through that way.
What was the kind of like conversion rate on that? Like, do you know about like how many people you reached out to, how many people wound up saying yes, like, doing all the legwork for the cold calling, like what did the results of that?
So that was harder than I expected. I think I reached out to 70 something people, different tiers, right? So I did like, I had my top 10, right, that I sent out first. And then I gave it a week. I sent out another couple, like I think 10 to 20 or so. And eventually I did four rounds finally and got to, I think, 70 total because there were some niches that I really, really wanted to fill and I just couldn't find that specific person for. Out of those 70, we had, what did we have? We had 10 people sign up. I think technically we had 11, but then one had to drop out last minute. But I think our overall count was 10. So I don't know the percentage off the top of my head with that, but it was a lot.
That's fine.
It was a lot that I felt like I was emailing people constantly. Which maybe there's a better way of doing that next year. I don't know. I'll have to figure that one out. But it also got the result that I wanted. And the people who did end up participating were really engaged and active and sharing it on their social platforms. So I have no regrets. I mean, if it took that many emails to get the quality people that I did, I'm more than happy to do it. And then our bundle return rate was good. We had, I think, total at the end of the week, just a little under 400 people sign up. And when I looked at the metrics on the back end, we had about a 55% conversion rate. So a little over double people found it. And then out of that, 55% actually signed up and picked different gifts. Some people collected them all, like Pokemon. Other people just took one or two that they were really struggling with and wanted to just focus their energy on that. So I'm just glad that we were able to help so many people.
Yeah, that's awesome. I was gonna ask like how many total people, like what was the subscriber
Yes.
count, but 400 sounds really awesome.
386 was the total, like, exact number of people who signed up for the bundle itself. And that's not including the contributors who also some of us kind of collected some fun freebies along the way too, which was a nice bonus.
Right. I've definitely like been a part of a bundle or like gotten a bundle and then like gone too deep into collecting everything. And so I'm on a bit of like a digital product hiatus for now until I like take some time to work through the stuff that I've got, figure out what I actually need to learn. 'Cause sometimes you just see like that dollar sign value and you're like, well, I gotta get it. Like, girl math it. I'm losing money if I don't get
I know.
this.
And it's tough though, because you're right. I'm in the same boat where, like, if I see a deal, I want it. And, like, I know I'll need it at some point in time. So why not get it now while it's at a great price? The problem is that sometimes, at least for me, then they're rotting in my email inbox. And by the time I get to it, the information's out of date anyway. So if someone's going to participate in a bundle, maybe they, if you have no idea what a bundle is and it's the first time hearing about it, my tip to you is think about what you want to get out of the bundle and as hard as it is to try and just collect the freebie for that one piece and then use it, right? It's so easy to kind of productively procrastinate by thinking that you're doing all this stuff for your business but not actually getting anything done. Because you're just in learning mode constantly, but put it into action.
Yeah, that's great advice. I wanted to take a look. I pulled up my ConvertKit, 'cause what I did for this email or for this bundle that I haven't done for previous emails is I actually created a follow-up sequence 'cause usually I forget. And this time I was like, okay, I'm gonna create a follow-up sequence, but I'm also gonna give them a break because I know from experience when you get a bundle, you sign up for everything, and then your entire inbox is just like absolutely flooded with everyone's welcome sequence and everyone's this and everyone's that. And it's like, I'm still unsubscribing from people who I like opted into bundles like over a year ago. So when I built my welcome sequence for this one, it was like, you get one email immediately with access to your product. And it says, I'm not going to email you again for 2 weeks. And I
Smart. That's
didn't.
really smart.
And
How
then
did
in
it
2 weeks,
work?
I came back and I was like, hey, remember that thing that you downloaded that you forgot to take a look at? You want to take a look at it now? And it worked pretty well. It has a 67.9% open rate, 3.4% click rate, and 12 people unsubscribed. So, which I feel like for a bundle is pretty good. Usually I have like a much higher unsub rate from bundle stuff. So yeah, I got like close to 60 people overall, I think, and it was
And
pretty
that's
fun.
fantastic. That's fantastic. And it's a testament to the work that you do of how many people actually stayed. If you had 60 people show up, and only 12 unsubscribe, because there's always going to be the freebie chaser who just wants it and then pieces out. But if they're staying in your community and getting to know you and participating in your world, I mean, who knows what that's going to turn into at a different point, whether it's a paid product or service, or maybe they have a friend who they know that really kind of needs you, and then it spreads that way.
Exactly.
That's fantastic. I'm glad that that worked out well for you.
Yeah, and that's the one thing that I've noticed through, like, participating in these bundles and, like, doing summits and visibility stuff is, like, for me specifically, it takes people a long time to convert because, you know, they're, like, larger investments and they're longer-term things. So it's not like you're going to get this freebie and then be like, yes, I will give you $3,000 for, like, this big marketing project that wasn't even on my mind. So I think being patient has been a really big part of finding success with this type of marketing too, because it's not always like snap of the fingers, like I made thousands of dollars overnight and you can too.
Which is hard, because if you look on Instagram in particular, there's always those stories about like how they start with nothing and then they open a business for affiliate marketing and they're multimillionaires by the end of the week. Which sounds wonderful. I have yet to experience that. So maybe I'm doing something wrong. But like that would be, it is a commitment. And whether it is any type of business, if it's a marketing business, if it's a coaching business, if it's a therapy business, that yes, there will be some people who are instant buyers. But there's also a lot of people who they need to get to know you. They need to build that trust, that authority to know that you know what you're talking about, before they feel comfortable opening up their wallet for any type of product, let alone a multi-thousand dollar project.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is a fantastic lesson for us to end on. So why don't you share with our listeners where they can find you, how they can learn from you, and what you got going on?
Sure. Yeah. So my kind of biggest face platform right now is my blog, stresslesstherapist.com. Where you can see the content that I post regularly. I also post show notes that I have from a YouTube channel. And there's a whole bunch of different freebies on there that if they want to collect, anything ranging from how to start a private practice, and there's like a nice checklist that goes with it, to just different ideas on how to diversify your income, and even a nice packet on if you're ready to quit that agency job, what are the steps that you need to take? Because I know, for at least for me, that was a big one. I knew what I wanted to do, but the idea of what to do and how to do it was overwhelming. So I have it all listed out for you. So they can find that right on the homepage. It's nice and simple. There's no searching needed.
Awesome. Well, that will be linked in our show notes. Thank you so much for hanging out with me this morning and taking up a therapy hour to do so.
No problem. Happy to be here.
And thank you to our listeners for sticking around to the end of this episode of Messy in the Middle. We might be back next week, or this is the season finale. I haven't decided. So stay tuned to find out.
Season finale.
Bye.
Bye.